crossroads of empires, battleground of the ages, city of peace and of war. This is Jerusalem, where archaeology uncovers the empires of yesterday, where prophecy decodes the headlines of today. This is where history and prophecy come alive. This is Watch Jerusalem.
Hello and welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm your host, Brent Noctegal. Today we're coming to you again from Jerusalem, Israel. A special thank you to Christopher Reams for helping me out with a couple of shows while my voice recovered. First up on today's show, I want to discuss with you an outlandish attack that took place on Thursday on a Syrian chemical weapons facility and what it says about Israel's position in the world and what it also says about the world's moral acceptance of leaders such as Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. That's first up. On the second half of today's show, we're going to talk about a recent discovery of numerous seal impressions in the ancient city of David. These range from about 2,700 to 2,600 years ago, and these impressions have very interesting names on them, names that indicate an alignment with events in the biblical text. So please stay with us. That section will be coming up in 15 minutes or so. Welcome once again to Watch Jerusalem. After midnight on Thursday morning, Israeli jets took off from Israeli territory, headed north into Lebanon, and while over Lebanese territory, they fired into Syria, and several missiles at 2:42 a.m. hit their intended target, which was a Syrian military site known for its production and development of chemical weapons as well as stockpiles of other weaponry. And this was a very audacious and somewhat unique attack in the Syrian civil war perpetrated by Israel. Of course, Israel is tight-lipped about it. They aren't talking or claiming credit for this attack, and yet it does fit that Israel is responsible for this attack. Now, about this specific target, it was an official and military structure of the Syrian regime, and that's what separates this from other attacks. There's been, I believe, over about 100 attacks by Israel against mainly convoys of weaponry that were destined to get into the hands of Hezbollah, and this is something that Israel has set as a red line. And they have conducted a number of airstrikes against those convoys throughout the Syrian civil war. And yet this was a very unique attack in that it targeted a direct regime facility. Now, this facility was in the northern Hama region. It was apparently one of the Scientific Studies Research Centers, or the CERS building. This is a government agency of Syria that's long been associated with the manufacture and development of chemical weapons, and also the development of the barrel bombs that we've seen used so much by Assad against his own people. Now, as I said, Israel is sticking to their policy of neither confirming or denying its role in the attack, but there is really no doubt that Israel was behind this very targeted, very specific attack against the Assad regime. Now, what I find very interesting about this attack, well, there's a number of things that are interesting about this attack, but the one that I want to focus on briefly in this first segment is the fact that Israel isn't receiving, or that foreign governments aren't heaping praise upon whoever did this, because this is what could be described as a very worthy target, similar to the target that Mr. Donald Trump, the United States president, focused on back in April when we saw that just huge chemical attack using sarin gas by Assad against his own people. And Trump saw those images and he decided that he was going to make some type of response. And that response was the firing of nearly 60 Tomahawk cruise missiles from the Mediterranean and blew up the airstrip, which those the airstrip that was used to facilitate that sarin gas attack. Now, Israel is doing something similar. It's actually attacking the facility that creates those nerve agents that creates Assad's weaponry. And yet there isn't too much out there in the media talking about how wonderful it is that somebody is trying to stop Assad from using these chemical weapons and developing more chemical weapons to use against his own people and others. Of course, the Israelis are worried that this weaponry could get in the hands of Hezbollah, as it looked like it was going to do, and then be used against them. Now, I just want you to consider a few points in relation to this, in relation to the fact that in our world, such an attack doesn't receive much praise, doesn't receive much publicity, to the point that people are saying, finally, somebody did something. That's what you'd expect, considering these following points. On Wednesday, this past week, a day before the attack took place, the United Nations Independent International Commission of Inquiry on Syria, they released a statement saying that it had compiled extensive evidence to show that Syrian forces under Assad had used chemical weapons 20 times during the Syrian civil war. Of course, this included the much publicized sarin gas attack I talked about earlier that took place in April this year, which resulted in the deaths of 83 Syrians. And we don't need to dwell on that too much, just because of the images were so grotesque and so saddening, seeing the children that were targeted by this attack. Now, Russia and the Syrians, they claimed that an unknown weapons depot had been hit, and that's what caused the explosion and then the carnage that we saw from that sarin gas attack. And yet this independent inquiry said that's absolutely completely false. This was a deliberate attack using chemical weapons by Assad. That came out a day before this attack that Israel just made against this chemical weapons development facility. So consider that. Consider also that this facility, according to Times of Israel, was recently used in a joint project with Iranian specialists to develop chemical weapons capable of going on missiles. So the Iranians were working with the Syrians in this location. Hezbollah, the Iranian proxy, was also known to have visited the site numerous times this year and were probably using it as a transit site, transit hub for some of its weaponry. And there's also a growing indication that Hezbollah may have been in the process of actually taking over this facility for its own use. Then we can consider back in early August, where an independent panel of the United Nations experts submitted a report to the Security Council that said that two times in the past 6 months, Damascus or Syria had been caught receiving shipments from North Korea, shipments of chemical weapons parts. And these were, again, taken. They didn't make it to the Syrian government. But it just shows you that they were continuing to develop chemical weapons. They were receiving help from North Korea and the Iranians to develop chemical weapons. And remember, this comes after, in 2012 and 13, when the complete stockpile of the Syrian regime's chemical weapons were supposedly removed from Syrian soil. And yet, they are still doing it. They're still developing chemical weapons. They still plan to use them. Israel's worried that they'll use them on them. They've already used them time and again against their own people and lied about it. Lied about it often. Now, the day after Israel had this attack, Bashar al-Assad, he wrote to the UN. He wrote to the UN denouncing Israel's actions at aiding the terrorist groups. This action of destroying one of its chemical weapons development facilities. It actually wrote to the UN and complained about that. Now, you can probably recall also, finally, that 10 years ago, almost to the day, back on September 6, 2007, Israeli jets, they had another flyover, and they destroyed back then a secret nuclear facility in Syria used for the production of plutonium to go into a nuclear weapon. Now, this reactor had been built with the aid, again, of North Korea and the Iranians. So let's put all these points together and see how much of a worthy target this was for Israel. If we take these points together, we learn that the Assad regime, for over a decade at least, has been trying to develop chemical and nuclear weapons. We learn that Bashar al-Assad, he's in the habit of lying about his development of nuclear and chemical weapons. We learn also that he has no problem using chemical weapons on his own people, and he's even willing to share those weapons with Iranian proxies such as Hezbollah. So with this in mind, you would think that the world would heap praise upon Israel for annihilating such a humanity-destroying site such as this facility. Instead, what do we see in the world right now? We see the international community, it seems, they're about to overlook Assad's failings and accept his continued rule in Syria. That's what's about to happen. That's what it looks like is about to happen. That Russia, the Iranians, Europeans, even the Americans are willing to accept Assad as the ruler of Syria, even though he has, for the past decade, been trying to develop chemical and nuclear weapons, and he's even used some of them on his own people and wants to use them upon others. Now, this is just, it is really shocking to me, the international community's tolerance for Assad and its negligence, because it tolerates Assad and what Iran is doing with him. It's the world's negligence for Israel's legitimate security concerns. And what it reveals in this attack, what it reveals is that Israel is becoming increasingly isolated at the precise time that its enemies are growing stronger. They're becoming more violent. They're becoming more, they're getting more enhanced weaponry. And they're even getting closer to Israel's borders. And yet Israel has to act on its own in a situation like this. The world, it seems, has largely become deaf, including the United States, actually, become deaf to Israel's security concerns, even as the screaming jihad against the Jewish state becomes louder and louder. And for this reason, we see Israel doing what it can by itself. It's right now, as I speak, it's undergoing the largest military exercises in the past 19 years, these 10-day long exercises. They're aimed at preparing for what? For a land and missile attack by a combined Iranian-backed force in the north of Israel. This drill involves tens of thousands of soldiers, thousands more reservists. The operation, again, is Israel's way of being prepared to go it alone if Iran decides to mobilize its proxies in southern Lebanon and now on the Golan Heights, the Syrian Golan Heights. Now, remember back, I guess it was about 2 weeks ago, 2 or 3 weeks ago, we had Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu go up to Sochi, I think it was, and meet with Putin and talk to him about the necessity that Israel has that Iran be pushed back and its Shiite proxies be pushed back from the Syrian Golan Heights. And yet he came away from that meeting to no avail. And we've got right now the Iranian-backed groups 20 kilometers, I believe it is, 20 kilometers from Israel's border, not just in Lebanon anymore, but in Syria. And that they're allowed to be there, not just by benefit of their backer in Russia, but also the United States agreed to that. They agreed to that. And so Israel is here trying to prepare and do whatever it can to get itself ready for what it sees as an attack that will come at some point. And it is ensuring that even with this targeted strike, that Hezbollah doesn't get chemical weapons, because they would be fired against Israel. Again, while Israel is trying to develop the military capabilities to protect itself in the face of such threats, the world, it seems, becomes more and more deaf towards what Israel sees as its legitimate security concerns and what anybody should be able to see as its legitimate security concerns. Now, if we look at this through the lens of Bible prophecy, it's very interesting because there is one power, and I'm not talking about the United States, although it looks like the United States does recognize right now at least Iran's march across the Middle East, but there's another power that recognizes what Iran is doing. Gobbling up territory across the Middle East, gobbling up Iraq, gobbling up Syria, already got Lebanon in its bag, at least for now, and its desire to attack Israel. And Israel is looking for allies. It's looking for allies in the Sunni Arab states, and it might find a temporary ally there. But in the long run, you can't trust them. The people, the Arab street, even in those Sunni states, does not like Israel. They might dislike Iran or think Iran is a greater threat at the moment and therefore team up with Israel. But Israel itself is looking for other allies. And in light of that, I think it's interesting that at the very time that this attack took place, Israel's president, Reuven Rivlin, was where? He was in Berlin. He was in Berlin to meet with German Chancellor Angela Merkel. And what was their conversation about on Thursday? This is what Israel Hayom said. He said Israel Hayom came out and published the conversation itself. And mainly, it was emphasizing Iran. It was emphasizing that Iran was about to, quote, drag the whole region into war. Israel sees this as just isn't about Israel, although that is one of the great goals of Iran. It's about the entire Middle East. And who was he talking to? He was talking to the German leader. Now, this is interesting because of what Bible prophecy says. Bible prophecy indicates that Israel is going to reach out to a certain nation in the face of the threat that it will face from Iran, both because Iran is growing in power through the region and also because of Iran's designs for Jerusalem. For Jerusalem, for championing the Palestinian cause of East Jerusalem as its capital. Iran is going to get more involved in that, and because of that, Israel is going to look for an ally in Germany. That's what biblical prophecy says, and already right now, we have President Reuven Rivlin up there in Berlin talking to Angela Merkel, Chancellor of Germany, who for the moment hasn't done much about the spread of radical Islam. But there will be a German leader that will do something about it. And they will. They will answer Israel's call. Now, they're going to answer Israel's call, but it might not be, well, it won't be for the benefit of Israel in the long run. Now, I'm not going to dwell on this any longer, but what we see in this attack is just Israel's decision that at times like this, it sees the danger. Even if anyone else isn't going to act, it has to act, and it will act alone. Now, this will only go on for so long until it reaches out for another ally, and that ally will be Germany. Now, for more information about this, please request our booklet. It's by the Watch Jerusalem editor-in-chief, Gerald Flurry. It's entitled Jerusalem in Prophecy, and it talks about the growing isolation that Israel faces right now, and how it is going to be pushed into the arms of one of its greatest enemies historically, thinking back to World War II and what happened there. Well, it's not only going to be pushed into their arms, it's actually going to choose. It's going to choose Germany to come and help it in this situation with Iran. Now, we're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to talk about an ancient German attack on the Israelite nation, and specifically how it relates to the discovery of the seal impressions in the city of David. You won't want to miss this next section, so please hang around.
This is Watch Jerusalem on kpcg.fm. Thank you for listening. They call it the City of Peace. But it is filled with violence. Yesterday, bloody crusades and sieges.
Today, terrorism, rocket attacks, and stabbings. Intense international pressure, but no diplomatic solutions. This is Jerusalem. No city has suffered like it. Will there ever be peace? God says yes. There will be peace in Jerusalem, and not just for the Jews. It will be a peace that spreads to all people. How will God bring peace to Jerusalem? Request your free copy of Jerusalem in Prophecy to find out. The answer comes straight from your Bible. Peace is coming soon. Act today. Please visit thetrumpet.com. Watch Jerusalem.
Welcome back to Watch Jerusalem. I'm Brent Nachtigall. We're coming to you today from Jerusalem, Israel again. There are recent excavations that have taken place in the city of David, which is the most ancient part of Jerusalem, just south of the Temple Mount walls. And the excavation is, I think it might be still ongoing, I'm not too sure. But in the last couple of weeks, they released a finding which is kind of startling because it really does back up a biblical event that took place 2,700 years ago. Now, this excavation took place just below, I guess it's between Area G, I would say, and the Gihon Spring, for those familiar with geography in Jerusalem, in the city of David. And specifically, there were a number of stamp seal impressions that were discovered. Now, these stamp seal clay pieces, they're known as bullae, and they were used to seal ancient documentation in the exact same manner that a modern wax seal would be used to seal our documents. We're back in the Middle Ages when they sealed their documents, and they would carry names of officials, and occasionally they'd have small motifs, or they'd even be pictographic as well. And there was recently, as I said, a small trove of these that were found from the dates before the destruction of the first temple. So we're talking before the 586 destruction, before the Babylonian Empire under King Nebuchadnezzar came down and besieged Jerusalem and really wiped it out. Well, there were people obviously living in Jerusalem before that time, and some of them had their very own seal with their first and last name on them. And we have talked about numerous seals on this program that have been discovered of biblical figures, the most prominent of those being King Hezekiah's seal himself. Now, while this excavation didn't find somebody that was necessarily from the Bible or a first and last name that matches from the Bible, what's interesting and what the archaeologists have drawn attention to is that we have a number of biblical names on these seal impressions that aren't typically Judean. They belong to, or their names that would typically come from the northern tribes of Israel. Now, you'll remember that after King Solomon died and his son Rehoboam started to reign, that the kingdom of Israel split off from the kingdom of Judah. Judah, Levi, and Benjamin, they would be the southern kingdom of Israel, or the kingdom of Judah that we'll know them as. And then the northern tribes, the 10 tribes, they would have a totally separate government for the next couple hundred years. And there would be family names that would remain in that northern kingdom that wouldn't really exist in the southern kingdom, which would be very rare in the southern kingdom. And yet we have, according to these archaeologists and their discoveries, we have a number of biblical names that are typically associated with the northern kingdom that have been found in the southern kingdom. Why is that? Names such as Pinchas or Phineas or Menachem or Menahem, they were found in this excavations. They're not Judahite names. They're not Jewish names. They're not names used in the southern kingdom. They're names, again, used in the northern kingdom. So what happened? How did these names get into the southern kingdom? And this is where we can bring the biblical narrative in. Now, the archaeologists there discussing this, they said that the likely answer is that these bullae or these seal impressions of these people belong to Israelite refugees and or their descendants that fled into Judah around the time of the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. Now, I want to go through the biblical scene that likely led to this event taking place, these names being found now within the southern kingdom of Judah. And as far as with the excavations, they were saying that they were found in the context after King Hezekiah. And that's when the Bible says that these northerners would have traveled down into Israel to not just escape the Assyrian captivity that was taking place in the tribes of Israel to the north, but also because the Bible indicates that they actually turned back to God. Some of them did. You remember that the northern kingdom of Israel was almost completely, well, every single one of its kings was unrighteous. Didn't follow the true religion. They followed in the way of Jeroboam that actually changed the religion. They changed the religion. It changed the feast days, the holy days, to different periods. It even stopped Sabbath worship. It introduced idolatry as well. And yet, it seems that there were some people, when threatened with the Assyrian Empire taking them into captivity, decided it was time. It was time to come back down to Judah, to restore their relationship with the house of David, to, again, come under the king of David's line, and then come under the righteous rule at this point of King Hezekiah. Now, just as King Hezekiah was coming into power, and just before him is this period when the Assyrian Empire was coming across the Middle East, marched into the northern territories of Israel and started taking tribes. Now, of course, this is the beginning of what's known as the Lost Ten Tribes after they went into the Assyrian captivity. Yet there were some members of those tribes that escaped. Now, again, this is just a really important and interesting time period because you have this moment. You have this moment, and again, these bullets capture this moment where God reached his hands into the northern kingdom of Israel. As they're about to be taken into captivity, as some of them were being taken into captivity, and said, well, let's just look at the Bible and see what was said. And if you want to read along with me, this is 2 Chronicles chapter 30. And I'm going to read from the New Jerusalem version of this. It says this, "And Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, and wrote letters also to Ephraim and Manasseh, that they should come to the house of the Eternal at Jerusalem to keep the Passover unto the Lord, the God of Israel. For the king has taken counsel, and his princes and all the congregation of Jerusalem, to keep the Passover in the second month." So what's interesting here, and if you're not familiar with the biblical history here, you could just read over that. But Israel hadn't come down to worship and keep the holy days for hundreds of years. And yet King Hezekiah, motivated by God at this point, after he comes into power, this is in his second month, I believe it is, first or second month, definitely in his first year of reigning, he reaches out to the northern kingdom and says, Israel, the northern kingdom of Israel, it's time, if you desire, to come back down and worship and keep the holy days, unlike you have kept for hundreds of years. And again, this was at the precise time that Israel was being taken into captivity, that the Assyrian Empire was breathing down their necks and had already taken, as we'll cover, a few of the tribes into captivity at this time. And he sent his letters out. So I'm just going to read verse 6 now. "So the posts went with the letters from King Hezekiah and his princes throughout all of Israel and Judah, and according to the commandment of the king, saying, quote, you children of Israel, turn back unto the Eternal, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may return to the remnant that are escaped of you out of the hands of the kings of Assyria. Some of your brethren, some of your families, they have been taken into captivity. Yet God is reaching out to you through King Hezekiah and saying, come up to Jerusalem, come south to Jerusalem and worship the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel. Verse 7, "And be not like your fathers and your brethren who acted treacherously against the Eternal, the God of their fathers, so that he delivered them to be an astonishment. As you see, you've seen some of them already go into captivity. They're an astonishment to the nations. Israel is becoming extinct as far as dwelling in the Northern Territory. It is being taken into captivity. And Hezekiah continues, "Now be you not stiff-necked as your fathers were, but yield yourselves unto the Eternal and enter into his sanctuary, which he has sanctified forever, and serve the Eternal your God, that his fierce anger may turn away from you. For if you turn back unto the Eternal, your brethren and your children shall find compassion before them that led them captive, and shall come back into this land. For the Eternal your God is gracious and merciful, and he will not turn his face from you if you return unto him." So this is a positive message, and in a way, Hezekiah is acting like the last prophet to be warning Israel. All the other prophets, Elijah, Elisha, and many of the last 12 prophets, Amos, they had come and they had delivered their message to Israel. And Israel was going into captivity. And yet here we have a king of Judah reaching out to these northern tribes of Israel and saying, if you will return to God, he will protect you. And he will protect your sons as well and your children. And you know what? Those bule are proof of that. The fact that we have in this period leading up to even the time of Jeremiah and the 100 years after King Hezekiah, we have the existence now of names of northerners existing in Israel and in Judah. It shows that some of them answered the call. Verse 10 says this, "So the post passed from city to city through the country of Ephraim, Manasseh, even to Zebulun. But what happened? They laughed them to scorn. They mocked them. They mocked the messengers. Nevertheless, there were some of Asher and Manasseh and Zebulun that humbled themselves, and they came to Jerusalem." There were some. There were a few that did humble themselves. Verse 12, "And in Judah was the hand of God to give them one heart to do the commandment of the king and of the princes by the word of the Lord." So there were riders that went up there to Israel. Some of them didn't receive this message well. They laughed them to scorn, even as about three or four of the tribes had already gone into captivity. You can see this. You can see this from history. You can see this from the Bible. 1 Chronicles 5:26 says exactly that. This is about 30 years before this time, and it says, well, not 30 years, it's about 10 years before this time, and it says, "And they broke faith with God." This is speaking about some of the northern tribes. "They went astray after the gods of the peoples of the land, whom God destroyed before them. And the God of Israel stirred up the spirit of Pul, king of Assyria." God stirred up the spirit of this Assyrian king, and he carried them away. Who did he carry away? The Reubenites, the Gadites, and half the tribe of Manasseh, and he brought them unto Halah, Habor, Hara, and to the river Gozan unto this day. So by the time this message goes up by Hezekiah, half the tribes are already gone into captivity, or many of the tribes have gone into captivity. You'll notice the places that responded and the places where the letters went. They didn't go into Gad. They didn't go into Reuben. They didn't even go into Naphtali in the very north, because all those people were already in captivity. And yet many of the stiff-necked, hard-hearted, hard-headed Israelites still refused, even after they saw with their own eyes other tribes be already taken into Assyrian captivity. They laughed these riders and messengers of Hezekiah to scorn. And they said, "We're not coming. What are you, crazy? The Assyrians aren't coming back. We're fine exactly where we are." Well, there were some in Israel that weren't too sure, and there were some in Israel that decided it was time. It was time to come down into the southern kingdom. Now, that's what the Bible says took place a bit before this event. Some of the tribes were taken. We also have the actual annals of King Pul himself that even says this, that he came to the house of Omri, Bit Omri, which is Omri is one of the forefathers of the northern tribes of Israel. And it says that he took a number of places into captivity. Basically, those places on the eastern side of the Jordan River where Gad, Reuben, East Manasseh were. And it also says that he took the territory, he says, the wide land of Naphtali. That's written in the Assyrian records. that I took those people into captivity. That's what Assyrian records say. That's what the Bible says. And yet, even though that had just happened, the northern tribes of Israel, the rest of them that were remaining, the majority, the far majority, the large majority, decided not to heed Hezekiah's advice or God's advice. But there were some that did. Some of them, with eyes to see, could see what was coming upon Israel, and they decided to listen. Sure, some of them laughed at them, saying, Israel, Assyria's not coming back. They're not going to take the rest of us into captivity. But some listened. Some humbled their heart and decided to listen to God's message. And they went down to Hezekiah and they kept the Passover and they stayed there. And they stayed there. This is what 1 Chronicles chapter 30 says, verse 25. And this is just after the celebration of the Passover. It says, and all the congregation of Judah, with the priests and the Levites, and all the congregation that came out of Israel, and the strangers that came out of the land of Israel, they dwelt in Judah and rejoiced. These are the people that escaped the wrath of the Assyrian captivity. Remember, God warned, as I said, those northern tribes. He sent prophet after prophet to them. He even took them into captivity in waves. In waves, so that they could see what was happening. And they could have decided to change. They could have decided to repent. And they could have decided to go back to the house of David if they listened to what Hezekiah said. And yet, many of them didn't. Most of them didn't. But the few did. Verse 11 says again, nevertheless, some of Asher, Manasseh, and Zebulun humbled themselves, and they came to Jerusalem. And they got absorbed into the southern kingdom of Judah, to the point now that we can see their very own seals. Those seals are a testament to the humility of some of those people from Israel that decided, whether it was them, whether it was their forefather, they decided to come down and join Judah once again. Those testaments are a seal to those people, the humility of those people. They're also a testament to the mercy of God as well. That during the captivity, as some of the Israelites were going into captivity, he would give them one more warning. One more warning. And some of them would respond. And we can see their seals to this day. They just came up in the city of David in the last couple of weeks. Now, as I said earlier, Israel or modern-day Judah, they're being encircled by enemies. Assyria, the rod of God's anger, is once again rising, as we covered as well. But there is hope. There is hope. And God always does offer that hope to those that will listen and will humble themselves and really get back to the house of David as well. Now, to understand more of these prophecies, it's really critical that you do request that booklet I offered earlier in the program by Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flurry of Watch Jerusalem, his book, Jerusalem in Prophecy. Jerusalem in Prophecy. I think it's just amazing that at this precise time in history, when we see end time events and happen, I think it's absolutely amazing that at this precise time in history, when we see end time events being fulfilled, prophetic events being fulfilled, that we have the rise of archaeological discovery that put seals such as these right in our path so that we can think about why these the names of northern tribed individuals start existing in the southern kingdom after King Hezekiah. Because we read in the Bible why. We read that they're escaping the Assyrian captivity and that God delivered them because he's merciful and because they responded. And we know it happened. There's actual tangible proof that this happened. And it happened here in Jerusalem. Now, that's all we have time for today. If you want to look up more about these seals, you can go to watchjerusalem.co.il and you'll see a link there to an article about this. You'll actually see a little video as well. So make sure you check into that. Make sure you check watchjerusalem.co.il throughout the week as well for the latest of biblical archaeology and also biblically prophetic news from the Middle East. I'm Brent Nachtigall, and you've been listening to Watch Jerusalem, where history and prophecy come alive.